Hello and welcome to the Android Developers Backstage podcast.
Episode number
10.
We are double digits now, which means we must be real.
Woohoo! Yeah, so I'm Tor Norby from the Android Tools team.
And Chet Haas from the Android UI Toolkit team. And today we have...
Anwar Galoom from the Android Runtimes and Tools team. There's a lot of tools in there.
Yeah, well, you know, tools are...
I am totally outnumbered. Oh, no, there's tools. Oh, yeah. It's an all-tools show.
That's right.
We are the tools. So today we want to talk about runtimes.
Yes.
We're going to talk about art. We don't know much about art, but we know what we like.
Good.
So art was, let me see, history from at least my perspective, which is far less informed than yours, is art was introduced into the public in the KitKat release.
Yep.
But it was disabled by default, and you could enable it through a developer option.
Yeah, so it was... We knew there were some known issues with it, but we wanted to get it out there to flush
out
any. It
was too awesome, is that right?
Yeah, we thought people would die of shock if they. No, we wanted to flush out some of the compatibility issues. Actually, initially we were thinking we'd release it on a single device, and then all the other devices, like you know, sort of our new device and other devices, would be Dalvik. I think that's just too much of a headache to maintain two runtimes at that level. And, you know, for us, it made sense to sort of have it available everywhere, and then people could try it out, file bugs. We got a lot of really good bugs filed, as well as sort of this awesome following where people started, you know, popping up websites where they would talk about apps that worked with art and apps that didn't work with art that we were using to triage. So I think it was a success in that sense that we flushed out many, many, many compatibility issues.
Websites still in business? Are there still apps that?
Yeah, I think there's one called AndroidRuntime.com that had lists of apps that work with and didn't work with, and it was originally just like a text list of apps. And now, last time we looked, I think they had sort of when was it fixed? You know, was it fixed in the MR1 update, et cetera?
So at this point, do most apps work in Art?
Yeah, most apps work. Where we do find issues, there's a couple approaches that we take. And you know, we can get into sort of why they don't work, but sometimes there are things we can work around because we have more stringent checks in the runtime. So what we'll do is, you know, we'll say, okay, well, if you're targeting this API level, we'll just work around it.
So I've heard that Art does more specific stronger checks for JNI access. Is that one of those examples where...
That is one of those examples. We introduced Check JNI actually back in the Dalvik about a year and a half ago. We now have more checks, and some of them are always on. Actually, if they're free and cheap, we'll just leave them on all the time. But other ones are on when you're actually debugging your application, and because they're too expensive to have on all the time. So some of those did cause problems. The reality is those aren't the ones that are the most problematic. Those bugs were, in fact, you know, things that were latent bugs in applications.
Okay.
Now, you know, you could have sort of a behavior where you ignored it and it was innocuous, but it could be problematic in the future. There are some cases where it really is problematic. So, for example, I know we're going to talk about GC in a bit, but we now have a moving collector in Art, and in JNI you can get access to, the data from an array in Java. And it used to be that we would just return a pointer, a raw pointer, to the object array in your native code, and people would abuse that. Like they'd make changes there and expect those changes to be reflected in the Java side. When you have a moving collector, you can't do that because you don't want people assuming that pointers are into the Java heap aren't moving.
It was beyond arrays, though, right? Wasn't it like global reference? They would just sort of grab a global reference.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I just pointed to an object, right?
Yeah.
Then they'd memcopy the object.
Yeah.
So we had some checks that would look for that kind of abusive behavior in JNI, and we disable those checks if you're targeting earlier than a particular API. But if you ended up targeting a later API, and we did this before we had a moving collector, which is great because people were prepared for it. So based on API level, we would turn on the check, and most people were okay with it. There were some subtle issues though, where you know people weren't being quite as abusive as memcopying object arrays, or not object arrays but objects, but were having side effects on arrays they had references to and expecting to see it on the Java side. Well, when we have a movie collector, what we do when you, you know, when you're grabbing the data from a Java array is we make a copy of it most of the time. So what you see there and any changes you make there will not be visible on the Java side of things.
So you said that JNI is usually not where the problems were. What are the problems that apps don't work on?
So we're doing this thing called ahead of time compilation. And what that means is that at app installation or after an OTA, and I'll explain why we do it after an OTA, we'll compile the application to native code. And that's fairly different from what we did before. We used to do just-in-time compilation, where we sort of dynamically profile what was going on, looking for hot traces and then compile those hot traces. So it'd be a little warm-up time, there'd be a runtime cache of code and so on. And a lot of Java implementations do that. A lot of Java-like language implementations
do that. Does that mean that you make the assumption that all the code is hot and you're basically optimizing everything up front?
Well, yeah, I mean, we can. There's some heuristics that we have. For example, we assume that class initializers aren't hot.
Okay.
So we never compile them, which is good because there are these huge methods oftentimes, and compiling is usually exponential in code size. So you don't want to compile the huge methods that are executed once and then never again. It just takes up a lot of code and code space, and it takes a long time to compile, and will double your compile time or worse.
Right.
So why does this impact compatibility? Well, when you're compiling ahead of time, you have time to do more aggressive optimizations. But for those aggressive optimizations, there may be some assumptions you want to make. Now, the assumptions we make are all consistent with the Java language specification. So a good example of this, and we mentioned this in an online doc we have about making apps work with Art, is that your monitor enter and exits should be balanced in your bytecode, and so we check for that, and we check for that so that we can do certain optimizations downstream.
Right.
Now it turns out that many Java language implementations don't do that, and people who are using code obfuscation packages that not just obfuscate, classes and method names and so on, but also try to obfuscate control flow will sometimes violate that. So we were running into some issues there. So what do we do there is we would reach out to the, when we could figure it out, we would reach out to the folks who were using that that tool or developing that tool and asking them to be aware of this and make sure it doesn't happen on Android devices or Android applications.
So are you talking about ProGuard or other obfuscation? Because ProGuard is one of those things that we've integrated with Gradle and Studio and all that
stuff. Right, ProGuard, DexGuard, and the like, we've talked to those folks. And there's there are other tools as well, actually.
Okay.
And we've run into some interesting problems with some of the DRM features that people put into these things where they're, decrypting stuff and then dumping it on disk and then, loading that. It's just people have gone through great lengths to make sure that their apps aren't copyable. Mm-hmm.
So there's a general issue in the compatibility space. So I remember the original JNI issue when it came up a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. We were investigating moving collectors.
Yep.
And we immediately slammed into this wall where there were some really common engines out there in addition to individual apps that made wrong assumptions about, memory will never move out from under me, and therefore, most games crashed.
Yeah.
And at that point, you decided, we probably can't ship this right now because otherwise we're going to kill off the entire ecosystem. And then what you want is, everybody should have good behavior, so you can go out individually and you can try to, at least approach the game engine writers and, the big apps and one by one try to nail them down. But in the meantime, there's hundreds of thousands of applications out there. And how do you know when enough is enough? Or is the process of, putting the checks in there and then as soon as they build against this, they will crash, therefore they will fix it? Like, where is the asymptote where you say, enough people have moved over and the people who aren't moved over won't care about it anymore?
Yeah. I mean, we ask ourselves this all the time, and there's no easy answer. We've started to get a little bit more sophisticated about how we analyze what's in the Play Store and search for patterns in code in the Play Store. But in general, it is hard to know, so we've tended to rely on API level checks, like what API level are they, what's their minimum API level that they're targeting? Because if they are targeting something prior to us, perhaps putting in a check JNI check or shipping art or whatever, then it might be reasonable for them to expect this other behavior, and we should be compatible with the bugs. So we'll do that quite a bit, where we say, okay, well, if it's, you know, earlier than this API level, let's make sure we don't break them. And then, you know, anyone who's developing for, you know, current API level or whatever API level where, you know, this goes away, and we'll go ahead and say, you know, we're gonna make this assumption. And the reality is that, you know, if they are developing to that API level or later, they'll see the failures as they're developing. It won't be something that's already sort of shipped and in the store and then suddenly breaking on people. That's something we don't want. And we don't know a priori whether people are actively supporting or developing a particular application. I think we know for a lot of applications, but, you know, there are applications that haven't been updated in a while, and maybe just because they're working on it, you know.
So
we don't want to kill. We don't want to kill, you know, 500,000 apps, right, by breaking them on a new runtime. So we'll have workarounds based on target API level.
So large things like the moving collector, like, is that disabled if you're on previous?
Yeah, if your target API level is
one.
No, it's not that early, but it's pretty early. I think we can go back pretty far, like Gingerbread or whatever, and I can't remember what version that is. So there's some cases where, we can just say, this is bad behavior, this needs to change, because, you know, we talk about latent bugs, and then we talk about things that are just bugs that people shouldn't be doing that could have gone wrong whether or not we changed the runtime. It just so happened that they got lucky, you know, and it didn't break. And in those cases, we'll reach out directly to the developers. And, you know, we always test like the top N100 apps, right, that are, you know, in the Play Store to make sure we're compatible. And in those cases, we'll actually reach out to the developers and tell them what they're doing is wrong, or, you know, try to understand what they're doing and then help them work around it. And even explain to them why it's going to be broken in the future. And the good thing is we do all our development in AOSP, so they can actually go see what's wrong. For the language platform, which is what my team is responsible for, we try to do most of that, actually all of it at this point, in Android open source, so that not only can we collaborate with partners, which is really important, but we can point developers at things without worrying about confidentiality issues. They can just go look at it and they can see, oh, okay, that's why this is breaking. We don't need an NDA in place. It just, there it is.
Yep.
What was the main rationale for, you know, going with a new runtime as opposed to evolving an older one?
Well, it was a number of things. I think that team members had hoped for a while to rewrite parts of the runtime to be more modular, object-oriented, use C++, and so on. And in doing so, enable new features. I think one of the experiences, and this was a big issue that the Dalvik team had in the past, was in adding new features, it was a very painful process, sort of working through and ironing out all the bugs. And in fact, there were GC features that were added and then taken, you know, turned off or abandoned because they were never able really to get to the bottom of what was going wrong. And I think it's kind of fundamental, right? There's debugging, and then there's, you know, sort of complex system interactions. And if you don't have sort of things built the right way, it becomes hard to figure out, you know, where problems are. So for example, if you're, so here's a concrete example of what we did. So we have a new threading and locking system in ART, and there are performance reasons for that, but there are also correctness reasons. So we do things like lock level checking. We use Anatalysis, which is a system developed at Google for statically checking whether you're holding the right locks and you're doing certain things. These things ensure that large classes of bugs don't occur, right? But we had to rewrite everything to use that.
Yeah.
And then the lock level checking lets us do dynamic checking to make sure that locks are taken in the right order so the deadlocks don't occur. And deadlocking was an issue anytime we sort of messed around with the runtime. So that's one example of why we really needed to sort of rework the infrastructure that this was built on. Then I think we looked at some other things like GC, and it's hard to take GC as something that you can...
GC being garbage collection.
Garbage collection, yeah. That you can sort of incrementally add features to if it was designed to be simple in the first place, right? If it wasn't designed for... You know, so what we had in mind was like, let's build something where we could implement every different kind of GC if we wanted. You know, moving, semi-space moving, you know, generational, you know, just what we had before, concurrent mark sweep, et cetera. And that was just not going to be feasible in the existing infrastructure. And the example I brought up earlier about, you know, adding a feature to GC, we were trying to add mod union tables. And the idea there was, so when we do a GC, you know, we do it in the application's heap. The application's heap is actually made up of the zygote heap and the application heap. And we wanted to just do collections in the application's heap, right? Because the zygote's heap, there isn't much garbage in the zygote.
Actually, take a step back and talk about zygote for a second.
Oh, so
a mystery.
So for those of you who don't know, the Android application process and sort of runtime system in general is really well optimized for mobile. So using as little memory as possible and sharing as much as possible between applications. So one of the key ideas in the early days of Android and Dalvik in general is that they would create this zygote application process from which everything was forked. So when you created an application, you would fork off of the zygote. The zygote will have preloaded a lot of the framework, right? So you didn't have every app running around with its own copy of the framework loaded into memory. And you know, for code, of course, that wouldn't have been a problem except we were jitting, so you would have had, you know, larger code footprint there. But it's more important for the data structures that you need at runtime. And
does that mean that the Dex code for like the activity class is really only sitting in one place in memory? Yep. It's not in every single app?
It's mapped into the address space of every single app, but it's backed by, in
physical
most cases,
RAM.
A file that's or physical RAM
right.
that's just one copy, right?
Okay.
And that's an enormous savings. And there's some things that we did in ART around this too that I'll get to in a minute. So it's not just data, but also objects that get classes and objects that get initialized when you load the classes. Oftentimes, those don't change, right?
Right.
If they do change, like if you do make a modification on something in the framework's heap or in the zygote's heap, it gets copied, right? Because it's a copy
right.
and write kind of semantics.
But so, like, if you have, you know, like a care sets class, you know, mm-hmm. and it has all these constants for
UPF8,
those are all just going to sit.
Right. The class, for example,
yeah.
for that
yeah.
is going to be shared.
Yeah.
You're not going to make multiple copies of the class and statics and so on. So,
I'm sorry to sort of take this on a slightly different sure. tangent before we get back, but do you have any plans to support, you know, shared libraries? So one of the things I've heard from people who want to use, you know, Scala or
yep.
things like that is that there's this other runtime, and currently they have to put that whole thing in their app, right? Which means
right.
that every app has this 5 megabytes extra that can get ProGuarded, but really you'd sort of want it to be on the device so that all these apps could sort of share it. Is that something you thought about at all? I mean, I know we don't want to go to like DLL hell, you know.
So or even support library, if it was the same version of support library, because
yeah.
otherwise everybody's packaging all the classes.
Yeah, I mean, we've thought about this, and it would certainly help us with a lot of problems. So for example, you know, there's game middleware right out there, like
yeah.
game engines. You can think of Epic and Unity and so on.
Yeah.
And, you know, that probably counts for like 99% of the games that people download
right.
or whatever. But there are different versions of those, right? And if we find a bug in one version,
yeah.
and we tell, you know, game middleware vendor, you know, hey, you've got this bug, you know, they'll go and fix it. The problem is that they can't get the licensees to go and then update the game with the new engine. Because why would they want to do that?
And what you don't
right?
want is like for the apps to copy into
right.
the shared directory, the DLL.
Yeah, yeah.
yeah. Anyway, so let's just
but you know, we do some of this in the platform anyway with Google Play services and,
yeah.
and some other things. So
right.
where there's a service, but there's also some client-side code that's loaded for things like rendering maps and stuff like
yeah.
that. It's entirely possible, right?
Okay.
I mean, even without shared, so I don't know if people who are listening know about shared UID, but it's a mechanism in Android where apps can share user ID and then they can access each other's data and so on.
So there could be a Scala UID that sits with a lot of Scala.
You wouldn't want to do that. That would be a security issue. But it also turns out, by the way, in Android, you can load code from other apps as well. So you could do that. The problem is, I think, is really with developers. Developers aren't going to want to, in general, I think they're reluctant to have some fundamental piece of their application they're using ripped out from under them, right? And because they haven't tested on it.
Right.
I think they do that for Android because they're confident that we've tested it. But you know, random middleware provider probably has less trust from the app developers. Yeah. So,
all right, you were in the middle of talking about the zygote.
So
let's go back to the zygote,
which was already a fork from the original conversation.
I think we're sort of like you know, winding back to the beginnings of Dalvik. So which is fine. So we have the zygote. Everything's forked off that. Zygote has its own heap. We create a new space, a new region of memory where we allocate objects for the application. When we're tracking live objects, you know, we'd like to, in most cases, things in the zygote live a long time. So we'd like to just sort of track objects in the applications heap. But we have to be aware of references to those objects from the zygote, right? There might be something in the zygote where we're actually pointing at this thing and. I want to make sure that that we track whether those things are alive and don't reclaim them. So there was an idea that to sort of create this thing called a mod union table where we have a distillation of what references between the two heaps are keeping things in the application heap alive, as opposed to just scanning the entire zygote heap to figure out what things are alive in the application heap. So they tried to do that in I think in ICS, and it was just I think with enough time it would have happened, but it was months and extremely painful, and they could never find sort of those last bugs. So this is a fairly racy kind of thing. Part of that has to do with the locking and threading infrastructure. And part of it has to do with, I think, sort of the GC implementation not really being designed to accommodate these different things. And you don't really know exactly where to plug things in, or things might have been distributed across multiple files and so on. So we have that in ART. We had that in ART from the beginning.
Right, so let's talk about sort of the advantages of ART now. What are the things that are better from a developer perspective?
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff that's good. And I should say, by the way, Dalvik had a lot of really good stuff. I think that for the problem that they were trying to solve, in this very constrained, device specs that they were dealing with at the beginning, they did a great job. Mm-hmm. Very, very compact bytecode, very fast to interpret, and the GC was good enough, frankly. I think things have grown fast, right? We have, when I did my PhD thesis, I used a Cray supercomputer. And phones were faster than that like 5 years ago. It's crazy, right? I mean, and this thing was like, in liquid, cooled. Anyways. So things have gotten pretty awesome in the mobile space. Apps are far more sophisticated. I think, there's an expectation of UI sophistication that wasn't there back in the day. Which is excellent.
From my standpoint.
Yes, it's full employment for you. So I think while Dalvik was pretty awesome, I think we did need to get ready to start growing in these other directions, and just like the mod union table and other things we've discussed, I think it was hard to do that with Dalvik, and we had to go come up with something where we could do this. So what were the key things? So ahead of time compilation. So why would we want to do that? Why isn't JIT awesome? And people do this all the time. JIT is awesome. I think it is nice to have dynamic information and only optimize the things you care about. Have for example, hot path information and so on.
But if with ahead of time compilation, how do you do branch prediction?
Well, so you can use profile information to do that. We don't currently, and frankly, we didn't do a lot of that in Dalvik's case. Right. So we didn't really lose anything going to that.
So this is an opportunity going forward.
Right. It is an opportunity going forward. It's still an opportunity going forward. In fact, we can still do just-in-time compilation if we wanted. I was trying to be clever, and I was, talking about ART as sort of the all-the-time compilation system. But ahead of time seems to be sufficient now. And so with ahead of time compilation, we can do a ton of things. So we talked about the zygote, having preloaded all these classes. So you start up the Zygote, you preload these classes. Well, what if we could pre-initialize those classes at compile time? Compact them, drop them to disk, and then mmap that file back in. So why is that an improvement over Zygote? Well, we don't have to pay the cost of preloading these classes, right, at boot time, so it should speed that up a little bit. But that's kind of a minor benefit. I think the bigger benefit is that...
Was this a what-if, or is that something that Art actually does?
That is something that we do.
Nice.
So in doing that, what do we get? We mmap this file. In Android, you may not know this, but... we don't have a swap file, so the only things that the operating system can page out are things that are clean pages that are backed by a file. And so it turns out that whatever percentage of the preloaded classes, in this case the pre-initialized classes that we have that haven't been modified by applications, can be cleanly swapped out to disk. So in theory, the theory is that these apps. The Zygote should be using even less memory, right? That if there is memory pressure, we can swap pages out, more pages out. And it depends on how many pages are clean versus not. Our experiments actually, and the Svelte stuff has borne that out, by the way, that it is, things do look better memory-wise. So that was one thing we could do. And so the nice thing about doing that, though, it's not just that, is that if we pre-initialize these classes and frameworks, then we statically know that this class has been initialized, and we can remove initialization checks in the code. This is one example, right? So imagine if, in every, static field reference or whatever, you're doing an initialization check. That's pretty expensive, and if we were able to pre-initialize it, then we know every time we're compiling an application, they're like, oh, I don't need to do that. I don't need to have this sort of, test, load, test, compare, and then branch, or load, compare, and branch thing in the code. So that's a huge benefit.
Resulting in faster startup time for apps?
Not just startup time. Well, it could be startup time, but also just runtime in general, yeah. Right? It could be faster runtime depending on...
As it loads in new classes that happen to be in Zygote.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. Also, we could do a lot of more aggressive type checking in the verifier. So we could try to figure out what the precise types of objects were and turn things like invoke virtuals into direct calls. Right. So when you invoke a virtual method, depending on how we handle this, right, and it's usually following the object to its class to the V table to it's a bunch of dependent loads and then a method dispatch, a call. Now if we just do an invoke direct, it's basically a load and a call, and you're done. In an object-oriented language, invoking methods is something you definitely want to optimize. So that's a huge benefit as well.
So I know that we had this page a while back sort of with micro optimization tips for developers, right? Mm-hmm. Saying,
we should really take a look at that page again.
I wonder if some of it's changed. It's one of those, one of the things I remember because I added the lint check for it was, hey, if you have a field, don't call your own getter on it, just use the field. That was one of those like optimizations that it seems like maybe here.
Yeah, I mean, getters and setters, field access, we'll actually try to inline that now. So we never inline things before.
So on Dalvik it was not inline, on Art it is.
No, now we inline. And so we don't do the sort of fully general inlining that you might expect yet. I mean, that's in our plans. But things like that in particular, things like that we will try to inline. And we've made method, even if we don't inline it, we've made method dispatch so much cheaper now that it probably doesn't matter.
Because I think that was another advice people used to give was, hey, if you have an interface and you have a specific class, it's better to use the class than interface, because that was...
So that's another thing we fixed too, is interface dispatch. So we actually have this thing called, calling it an IMT, and for some reason, interface method table.
That works.
Yeah. which basically is a little cache or lookup table where we can cache where interface dispatch went from various PCs, and then whenever we do another interface dispatch, we can say, oh, is this the right object, and then do dispatch on that. Otherwise, we'll go through a slow path, which does the chain of lookup.
Nice.
And we found that. So for example, I think it was like we have some micro benchmarks, of course, as well as bigger benchmarks. But for the micro benchmarks, they're testing interface dispatch. Usually, some iterator going through a hash map or something like that. We see huge improvements in using interface dispatch. So I don't think that it necessarily applies anymore either.
What was another of my favorite micro optimizations was Final Fields. When you're using them like locally, I don't know if you've seen this one. We certainly have a lot of them in the framework code. Like, okay. I don't even know exactly what it bought us, but it's okay. Sort of a pattern that.
I mean, there's other things too.
Aren't that thing final? I'm not sure why it seemed right. to be faster in some cases. I don't know if that was like a Dalvikism or an early day.
Well, I think this points to sort of like, I think the nice thing about this gets at our philosophy, right? Which is we would rather you use the features, the language, and then file bugs against us and we'll fix it. Nice.
So how do you feel about enums?
I like using enums. I think that...
you should talk to the framework team then.
No, I understand their concerns though. I mean, they do use more space, but I think if you just sort of look at, the stark difference between an int field versus an enum. But, I think what most people do with enums is they will have, methods to pretty print them and so on. And when you add that all in, the cost delta isn't that much. I think there are things we could do to make it more
I understand that the enum stuff, in order to guarantee that, with serialization, it's always a single thing, there's a lot of stuff it has to do up front.
Yep.
But that's something that conceivably you could bypass with ahead of time compilation.
Yeah.
Could you even turn simple cases into ints?
Possibly, yeah.
I mean, that would be really nice, right?
I thought ProGuard was doing something like this, or DexGuard, one of these things was trying to do something like this, and we've talked about doing something like this ourselves. We haven't gotten around to it, but that is something we want to look at, actually, because I think the type safety that enums buys you is really useful. I mean, I've run into this looking at, like, Activity Manager code where I can't figure out what ints belong to which, conceptual enum.
You just have to memorize all the code, and then it's easy.
Yes. I think long term this is what we want, right? Use the language features, and that should be a bug on not the developer, but a bug on us to fix it.
But for the record, and I think this is the framework policy, until you fixed it.
Yes.
The very line is.
The discussion for years has always been, well, that's not the way that the language should be used. And
right.
then the answer was, but that's the way that we have to use it now because
it's fair enough.
The state of whatever it was. In the case of enums in particular, those bring in a different issue than, like, we'll get into the GC issue, but it's the size of the object, right? So there's a couple of things that we worry about in framework
code. Well, the DEX code that's associated with it too, yeah.
Right. But yeah, I mean, it's the size of everything surrounding it. Like, if I have the choice of using a couple of ints or even better, bit fields in a single int, all of a sudden there's only 4 bytes taken up as opposed to the 1,000 bytes or whatever that class is going to take. There's another issue that we get into with GC about temporary object stuff that's sort of separate from that. But like the enum, no matter how good art is in general now, if it's still just a general data structure that is gonna take up a lot more space, then it's still something that we're gonna be concerned about.
Unless it maps to an int.
Right. And at that point, we could certainly consider it. And in particular, we could then consider it for framework code. There's also an important distinction between what we worry about on the inside of the framework and what application developers should really worry about, right? If an application wants to use an enum, hey, go for it, use an enum.
Right.
That is probably not going to be coming up in your inner loop. On the other hand, inside framework code, if we used enums everywhere we currently use bitfields and ints, we would be totally bloated, right? Because we have a lot of these things being passed around, and every app maps in a lot of these things.
Yeah, I mean, my advice to application developers is, go ahead and use it, but look for problems in terms of memory footprint or performance or whatever, and if you see that, then go ahead and optimize it, right? Like, turn them into ints or whatever. I think that's fine. I would suggest that people start with, sort of the using the construct and then...
First make it correct, then make it fast.
Exactly.
So speaking of language features, I'm going to channel our listeners now. When can we have Java 8 language features, like closures? What if I don't want to have an inner class? What if I just want to pass, a method?
Aren't anonymous inner classes with methods? And I mean, the IDE
in Android Studio, you get that IntelliJ nice folding. So it actually kind of looks like Java 8 language stuff.
You can use them that way. With Art, we've gotten better about tracking. Like with any runtime, it takes time to sort of, or any kind of system like this to give birth to it. But once it's out, I think we can do a better job of tracking the language specification. And things like lambdas are actually very interesting to us because of the impact they can have for developers, but also for the frameworks. You know, sort of how the APIs might change, become more concise or cleaner.
It's sort of ideal for callbacks. You know?
Right. It's a nice little piece of syntactic sugar, right? Yes. Versus using the anonymous interclasses, which can seem a bit, well, if you're a Java developer, you're used to it, but you know, yes. At first glance, it can seem convoluted. It's unlikely to be, from an implementation point of view, necessarily any more efficient than that. But yeah, we do want to do it. I think. And that's true of any of the language features from the spec, unless they're things that don't really matter in mobile, right. Or you know they're not being adopted widely. And we've certainly seen that before, where you know something sort of DOA because people there's something.
Do you remember when all the languages wanted to add XML literal syntax into the language? Remember that JavaScript was going to have that XML syntax
link. What, from .NET?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think being...
It wasn't XML. Yeah, it was like database query, but it was like strings embedded
I think they actually still actually use that. I hear people about that. That's a select from where stuff that they have, right? I think that might actually be more legitimate, but I do remember the whole like...
XML directive. Yeah.
I mean, I think being a year behind when they launched the feature is probably not a bad thing because you get a pretty good idea of how developers are embracing it.
Yeah.
Or whether they are or not, right?
Right.
So back to the ahead of time compilation. So there's a bunch of optimization opportunities, and we see like really good code performance improvements. And I'll be honest with you, the basic optimizations we're doing in terms of code generation. So these are things like register allocation and instruction scheduling, sort of the nuts and bolts of compilers. Isn't all that different from the JIT and Dalvik, to be honest with you. It's just all this other stuff has resulted in things being, you know, anywhere from 50% faster to, you know, 5x faster or better.
Do you feel like there's more room? I mean, do you feel like you've gotten all the low-hanging fruit out of the way, or do you feel like there's still many things you can do to squeeze more performance out of it?
I think we've gotten a lot of the low-hanging fruit, but there's still a lot more low-hanging fruit. I think in some cases there's another, you know, 3 or 4x on top of where we're at.
That's in addition to low-hanging fruit, or that's in fruit on top of the tree as
that's
well?
Fruit. Yeah, that's fruit at all levels of the tree.
Okay.
I mean, what's low-hanging fruit is sort of a matter of
depends on how big your ladder is.
Five feet. I'd put it at 5 feet.
Sort people, you know, right. So, for example, like method inlining is bread and butter for a lot of these kinds of languages, and we're not really doing it generally. So for some people, they might say that's low-hanging fruit. Like, well, you should be doing that, right? But, you know, when you're doing ahead of time compilation, I think you need to know where you want to do that. Otherwise, you get this, you know, code bloat, right? Where you're in line.
And what is that feature I always hear about? Tail call recursion?
Tail call optimization?
Yes, that's the one.
It's not a big deal, really.
It's for functional programmers.
Yeah. Maybe more Scala.
It's those Scala people again.
Yes, that's right.
So once you integrate the ability to put shared libraries into Zygote,
yes.
Then for all the Scala programmers, obviously,
yes.
You need that capability.
That's right. So that's the ahead of time compilation side. I think the other big area of improvement was in GC, and we've touched on this a little bit.
Thanks for listening. This is the end of part one of the ART conversation. We went really long in recording this, so we're going to break at this point, and we will see you soon with part two.